Hi friends! Today's episode is part of a two-part series on men's mental health and emotional needs. So today I'm talking to Sudhanshu Mitra. Mitra is a writer based in Bangalore, India, and I first came across an article that he had written for an Indian website called Agents of Ishq. Ishq means romantic or passionate love in Urdu, and Agents of Ishq is a website slash blog about sexuality and romantic love in India. So Mitra had written this article about men's emotional needs and how they're not being catered to and how they don't have the words to discuss their feelings. In the article, he talked about how men sometimes talk about sex or other things with each other instead of talking about feelings because it's just not a thing that you do. Or sometimes in a sexual situation, it might not be that the guy actually wants sex. It might just be that he wants to be held platonically, but maybe doesn't feel comfortable expressing vulnerability in that way and so ends up having sex. So that article had lots of amazing ideas and I was blown away, and I knew I had to have Mitra on the podcast. So I'm really glad that's happened. And on this episode, we've talked about a lot of really interesting and new ideas for me. We discuss emotional freedom for men and how men can understand their own emotions and why it's important for them to do that, why it's important for them to talk about emotions with their families and friends and peers, why it's important for them to go to therapy. We talk about patriarchy and how it affects both men and women, and how feminism is important not just to women but also men. For example, the idea of consent during sex and how it's a two-way street for men and women, and masculinity modeled by our dads and how that harms us or how that affects the way we think about masculinity ourselves. It's just a fascinating episode, and I recommend that you listen to it and share it with men and women in your lives, because we're really not doing that great by our men in understanding their emotional needs. And we really need to learn how to open up spaces for conversations about feelings, about men's mental health, in men's circles and between men and women. The audio quality of this episode is different from all our other episodes because it was recorded on Skype, because Mitra lives in India and I'm in Melbourne. And you can hear the rich, beautiful soundscape of urban India in the background of Mitra's voice. So that's also a very fun aspect of this episode. This episode also has some really cute surprise guest appearances. The first one is by the muezzin at the local mosque near where Mitra lives. He starts the afternoon prayers and then we had to halt recording for a while. The second one is by Mitra's cute cat. And the third and most surprising one of them all is my Indian accent, which suddenly emerges when I'm talking to Indian people. And I think that a lot of my immigrant friends will understand this phenomenon. So anyway, I hope you enjoy my Indian accent. Now, we've been going for a while. This is our 9th episode. And if you like what you're listening to, I hope you'll consider supporting us by becoming a patron on our Patreon. You can find the details of our Patreon on our website, heckandconcern.com. What that means is that you can support us with $1 or a few dollars a month to help us cover the costs of producing this podcast and just to give us a little bit of good feelings and joy. But you don't have to do that. Even if you don't do that, this podcast will always be free for you to listen to. And join the conversation. Please get on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook and tell me what you want to hear on this podcast. What is heckin' concerning you as a millennial, as a Gen Z, as somebody related to a millennial or Gen Z? And I want to talk about what you want to hear about. So get in touch and enjoy. This is Amrita, and you're listening to Heckin' Concerned Podcast. Heck, heck, heck. Hi Sudhanshu, welcome to Heckin' Concerned Podcast.
I mean, is it recording now?
Yes.
Okay. Hi, I'm Mitra. I prefer Mitra.
Right.
I mean, yeah, I'm a good at Sudhanshu also.
Okay.
But yeah.
So you prefer Mitra. Okay. So before we started recording, we were talking a bit about music, and you listen to angry music when you're angry or depressed.
Yeah.
Do you struggle with depression and mental health issues?
Yeah, so that was a phase when I kind of felt really low on most of the days. I would get up in the morning feeling like, you know, I've entered a different world and just cry for no reason. And there was a lot of low self-confidence and motivation for many things. And that was because of different circumstances in my life. But yeah, that period is 2017 to almost the beginning of this year, 2019. I did go through, you know, ups and downs in terms of depression. And I also took some antidepressants too during this phase.
Right.
So the antidepressants, SSRIs, did help me in coping, in just being functional and being able to do normal day-to-day things.
Right.
Right now I'm off medications, but over the years, I generally regularly go for therapy, and that's something that I'm continuing even now. And
good.
And also I've changed some of my social environment over the last year, and it's more conducive, and it doesn't easily put me on a depressive mode. Things have changed, but yeah, I do go through smaller phases of depression these days, but it isn't as bad as it was like probably eight months back or 6 months back.
How did you figure out when it was time to get help?
Because of different circumstances of work and relationship, it kind of felt like everything is going bad. And that started affecting me. And I think the period was when I guess it became a routine for me to, I would dream a lot, and then I would get up and feel like I've come into another world. And then I would just generally feel low and not feeling like going to work. And there's a lot of stress, anxiety, and it was just breakdown in the morning almost every other day. So during this phase, I realized that, you know, I need professional help. For me, it kind of gave me a space to understand what I was going through.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like another brain that's there with you and trying to think, and it's a non-judgmental space, and this other brain is trying to really work with you to figure out what is happening or give you some direction and give you some structure in your mind, link things, and also give affirmation where required.
Yeah.
So I think those aspects still help me even now.
I think that's so important and beautiful. In a setting like India, where a lot of the counseling happens really from people who have some kind of stake in your life, they love you, they care for you, or they come from it from a cultural perspective, like you might speak to your friends or your family or your elders might counsel you. This kind of going and speaking to a third person that's not related to you in a clinical setting is fairly new as of an idea in India, of taking the time out from your social context and being a very individual-centered approach, you know, of just me and my feelings and my thoughts and my space and my time to focus on me. This is, I feel, quite new in the Indian context.
It is new. That's true. It is new. And it's also because I mean, growing up, at least the relationship that I have had with family or, you know, friends is more of where after a point, I think during high school, like probably after high school, like you're just left to yourself in one sense. I mean, it's not like, at least for me, there wasn't space to talk about how was your day, what did you feel. For a long period of time till I started therapy, I didn't know words for, you know, many of the different emotions that I feel.
Such as?
Just as simple as, you know, trying to figure out what is anger, what is sadness, what is feeling, you know, isolated or feeling abandoned. It would generally be either anger or sadness.
Yeah.
You know, it would be like a binary. But to be able to reflect on, hey, I'm feeling this because this happened, is something that only came in the last 1 to 2 years, actually.
Yeah.
2 years.
Yeah. That moment when you are able to start identifying why you're feeling in certain ways and that you have a choice. You can feel that and you can respect the fact that you're feeling it, but the choice is still yours about how you will act based on those feelings. That is so empowering, isn't it?
Yeah, that is. And I think my first step was to just identify that, you know, feeling this and just name it.
Yeah.
I think that itself took quite a bit of time.
Mm.
And it's still a process. It's not like I've learned it fully, but it's way better than before. Like, if, let's say I'm having, you know, I'm affected by something that, let's say, a friend of mine or a partner of mine has done. I'm now able to articulate it and also say, I felt this.
Yeah.
But also, it doesn't mean that we have to find a solution right away. Just that I want to express this. And yeah, for me, the space is just for expression at this point.
Yeah. I feel that men are encouraged to express so many opinions all the time and express their feelings about all sorts of things, except what their feelings about their emotional needs are. Feelings like vulnerability, fear, sadness. These are feelings that men are never allowed to express, really. But for everything else, you're expected to have an opinion and you're encouraged to have an opinion. And in this, it's so sad in this way, men are stifled.
Yeah.
And gagged.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
When I started to reflect on before therapy and like reflect on my college experiences and professional experience just after my college, and I realized that I think at a certain point in my college, I decided that, so till then I would actually reach out to friends saying, hey, I'm feeling this, I'm feeling really sad, I'm feeling really angry about a certain, you know, thing. But I think there was a point I do kind of remember for personally, there was a stark point where I kind of told myself that I'm going to deal with all my emotions myself, and I'm not going to express it to anyone. It's like I need to deal with it all by myself.
Yeah.
You know, that space that was in a way there with my friends kind of stopped being there. And post that is when, like, you know, you do meet friends, but you don't really talk about what you're feeling. Or, you know, there's no, you'll never use the word feelings as such. And you are always meeting to do a particular activity, right? And watching movie or playing a game, or, you know, you're out eating or drinking. In a way, it's the structure, the societal structure is such that men generally, you know, talk about external things instead of their own, their own sort of trying to reflect on their emotions.
Yeah, you make such an interesting point that boys get together generally to do something, whereas girls are often able to call up their friends or meet their friends and say things like, I'm scared, I'm sad, I'm worried. So when you were growing up, at what age did you stop expressing these kinds of feelings to your friends?
This was, I think, when I was... I kind of stopped it and then started, you know, handling it myself.
But
it was
where
around.
Where did this idea that you need to handle it by yourself, where did that come from?
Yeah, this is something that I've been trying to think about. And one of the things maybe is that probably other people are also not expressing. It is like probably I was the only one. I felt like I'm actually expressing my emotions so much that some of my friends... You know, it's a burden for them.
Yeah.
So I kind of felt that. And also that, you know, I felt like, you know, it's something that I need to handle. Because, I mean, if I can kind of relate it to the fact that generally men are supposed to, you know, man up and handle it themselves. And they should always be able to, you know, fix things.
I've had friends... who have not been able to deal with their emotions, but when suggested that they go and get some kind of therapy or counseling, they have this very resolute look on their faces and they say, I don't need therapy. I can deal with this on my own. And then they clam up, they just shut up and refuse to share what's going on in their minds. And I wonder, is it because they don't have the words to share, or is it because, I mean, how can those emotions be so deep, so scary that they can't bring themselves to share it? There must be something else that's stopping them from sharing their feelings. And then the tangle just keeps growing in your heart, in your mind.
The thing that you talked about, I mean, the word that you used is vulnerability, right? I think that's that, at least in my experience till now, I think that's one of the core things that is very important for one to, you know, accept and, you know, practice also, at least for men. It's because I think that accepting that you can be vulnerable and then expressing your vulnerability is, it will change a lot of things in one's lives. It's not like men don't express vulnerability. They do express it in many different ways. But it's just not, you know, like, let's say you really have a bad breakup. I've seen friends going through, you know, low feelings. But I think then it's about how you handle the feelings post that. So basically I'm saying that you can see different ways in which men express that, you know, they're going through a really bad time or, you know, they're stressed. But I guess the way in which one's emotions can be handled, nurtured, given space for, or, you know, some sort of just seeking therapy, I think those things are necessary. If you, like, there has to be some sort of mechanism for you to understand how to deal with your emotions. I think that is more, and that's one of the things that I, when I read Bell Hooks, basically, I started reading Bell Hooks and it kind of shifted a lot of my thoughts in my mind. The Bell Hooks book, there's a book called Man, Masculinity and Love.
I've heard of it. Yeah.
That is, I think, a must read book for men like me, per se. Because I like the way Bell Hooks talks about feminism, patriarchal structures, and tries to understand the subjectivity of men and tries to also give directions.
So, you know, like, women are often portrayed as not in their humanity. They're often portrayed for the more physical appearance or some of the more what is perceived as feminine qualities. But often the other very human parts of their existence are erased in men's narratives. Similarly, in men's and women's narratives, a lot of the human parts of men are erased. They also are made to fit into a kind of a script or a sort of a stereotypical image of this strong man that doesn't have feelings, that doesn't... Yeah. And men are kind of reduced to this sex-centered creature, you know, sports, sex, food, money. These are the few things. Men are very simple creatures. They have very simple needs. They're reduced to such a... you know, cliche. So it's not just women who suffer because of these patriarchal notions of femininity. Men suffer so terribly as well because of this masculinity that has been built in cultures.
I guess the way I look at it is that it's, it just doesn't allow for you know, your fullness of your being. Like, it doesn't completely allow you to reach the human potential that you have within. Like, in the sense, it's very a narrow way of living if you just follow, you know, the notions that as men are taught. And in one sense, I also went through this where, I'll still go through this actually in different phases where I would at times look for sex, but actually in what I would need at that point is some physical affection or, you know, touch. Or I would probably need some probably emotional affection too. But then all of it would be like, oh, if I probably I should have sex, and that would answer the things.
Yeah. But that takes a self-aware person to reach that conclusion, that what you needed in that moment was emotional intimacy or a comforting physical touch, a platonic comforting physical touch was really what you needed, not necessarily a sexual touch. And but most people, I mean, not just men, but most women as well, it takes a very self-aware person to know in that moment what you really need. But I can imagine that it's a little bit harder for men, because apparently women love to cuddle, but men just want sex. So for a man that's expecting to live up to that idea, it must be even harder to introspect in that moment and ask, what do I really want right now out of this interaction with somebody?
Yeah, and I think a lot of it would have been fine if physical touch and affection and, you know, all that was okay between cisgendered men. It's not there. And I'd also, at some point, I'd written about it and thought about it, how there was a period of time, probably in my high school or something, where even my parents stopped, like, hugging me or, you know, touching me or, you know, giving physical affection. Of sorts. I mean, now it's back. Now it's kind of changing, and we hug each other and all that.
Yeah.
But during the college phase, and you know, for about probably 10 to 12 years, that stopped. And it's the same with my friends also. I mean, we never. It's usually when we meet, it'll be a handshake and a hug. Like, generally, it would be a handshake, and then I would push for a hug. So you know, it's just that, and it's not, if anything more, then there's this chance of, you know, sexualizing of the touch itself. And I mean, so you lack that there in the friends that you hang out with. Like, where would you seek it? Like, you would seek it only in your probably romantic or, you know, partner, romantic relationships. Or you would seek it through sex. I generally feel that everyone needs physical affection and touch at different points in their lives.
Yeah.
And I've been trying to understand, what are these avenues where this can happen?
What do you think prompted your parents or the parents of your friends to phase out physical touch? And when did that happen? When did that get phased out, and why?
I don't know. I mean, I've been trying to read about it and trying to understand what it might be. And it is that, you know, a person has grown, and now the person is post-puberty, and now you can't. And Bell Hooks also talks about it, about how that changes. And parents as such, probably they also think that he is like a grown-up boy and he'll handle it himself.
Yeah.
With friends, I think a large part of it is because it is like internalized homophobia, right? And you just sexualize. Like, even if it's like a hug more than like 3-4 seconds, then it's easily will be sexualized in the brains. And it's not just the it's not just that other people will sexualize it, but it's just that internally you will feel like, hey, what am I doing?
But this is the thing, right? So we don't expect men, unless it's a sexual or romantic scenario, we don't expect men to have these needs of physical touch and just reassuring physical affection. We're not led to have this understanding that it's okay to hug somebody without it being a sexual thing. It's okay to, you know, they've sort of, the different men and women and their roles have been segregated to the point where there's internalized homophobia on the part of people, and then there's also this confusion about what touching between sexes might be, and it's not all sexual. But we don't understand that as yet.
Yeah, I mean, essentially it is that. It is that there are particular roles that generally society tells you to play. But what I've realized is that once you, now, even if you know that, you know, this is because of particular societal upbringing or societal roles that is enforced, what do you do after that is also a question. Like, I don't think those feelings go away just because now you theoretically understand where it is coming from. It does help quite a bit. But I think in that moment, again, you have to have some sort of conversation around that, or reflection around that. And I guess that's the only way some sort of opening up of different kinds of relationships can happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Mitra, I know you don't like the word woke, but because you wrote an article about how not to be a woke boy that's just using his wokeness as an excuse to sleep with more women. But let's just say the positive connotations of the word, you are pretty woke. So does that make you, do you feel like your other friends are on the same level as you now, or do you feel left out?
I went through phases of, different, once I understood things theoretically, I would try to enforce it in all my circles. Like if there's a friend who's saying something sexist or casteist or racist of sorts, I would immediately react, or it would become an argument, or it would become I would react very easily. But I think over a period of time I've realized that one is that I've also been in the same place, and I think I need to recognize that that it's not going to change in one conversation. And these are smaller conversations that you need to have. Like, what are the ways in which you can still be, political, but also empathetic to the other person? And it takes some time to have those conversations. And essentially, you will end up explaining all the things that you think is going wrong in that space. But to do it in a manner in which, understanding that people have just internalized certain, responses to certain situations.
Yeah.
I've had a liberal arts education, and I've also met people who have taught me a lot of things. And then I started reading a lot of feminists, and I've learned from a lot of their writings too. So I have gone through that, process. And ideally, if you're like an engineering student from, let's say, Bangalore, you would never, unless you come across it on social media, you would never come across, first your circle will be largely engineers and, all the corporates that you will be part of, and you'd never interact with a liberal arts student or, an arts student or economics student or, a gender, a studies student. So you'd never interact with them. And so you have like a particular circle of people around you. You're only open to the social media discourse on, feminism is this, feminism is that, feminism is killing men, all of, you're just exposed to that discourse. And so, but the fact is that you're like, at least my circle are people like that. And either you'll have to deal with that. I mean, you have to reach out to them where they are and then build it. There's no other way, or you'll just have to stop talking to them.
Yeah. But it's very scary for women to take on that role of educating men. It feels like a punishment. It's like, first of all, we are the ones that have been subject to a lot of discrimination, and now we are the ones who have to be patient and also explain it to you. The other day, I went on a couple of dates with this guy, and on our second date, we got into a huge argument about feminism and patriarchy. This guy basically said, there's no such thing as patriarchy. And up until then, I was really enjoying my time with him. And then he said that I was devastated. There's no such thing as patriarchy. It's just the way it is. Nobody has told women that they can't do these things. His argument was, my father never told me to treat women badly. And my father never told blah, blah, blah. So it's not men who are passing this on. It's just the natural order of things. And
yeah.
After that, I went on another date with another guy who the topic got around to violence against women and stalking behaviors. And when I said the word, generally it is men who do these things. So he misunderstood me. He thought I meant that it is generally all men who do these things. So he got very angry and he said, oh, come on, not all men. And I hasten to clarify, but at that point I thought, okay, if you're not even going to listen to what I'm saying carefully,
Yeah.
or you know, your first knee-jerk reaction is to yell at me across the table, "No, that's not fair. Come on, not all men are like that. Not all men are like that." And you're invalidating what I'm saying even before you let me clarify, then
Yeah.
you're part of the problem.
Yeah, I agree that the labor of teaching men is need not fall always on the woman itself. But I have to say that I have benefited from women talking about it. And yeah, and in the end, of course, it's also what do the men do in their circles, right? And it's again about like, okay, you have a circle of men and there's some sort of locker room talk going on. So what do you do? I think those aspects of trying to really understand the situation and being able to articulate what is going wrong in that situation, I think that labor has to be done by men also, like all the, you know, the work.
So we feel that there are so many things about women that men don't understand. But what are the things about men that women don't understand? And what are some of the bad behaviors that women do towards men?
I think one of the basic things is that if you're being emotional or if you're being vulnerable, then what space do the women provide? Because as much as men are internalized to not show emotions, in a way I've internalized this notion that if men, because they wouldn't know how to handle men who are actually being vulnerable. Because you're so used to men not doing that, and then if men do that, then would you still accept the man, accept the person as they are, or would you be repulsive of that, of the person actually being emotional? I think that's one of the core things. I think that's one of the things that I've seen and experienced also, that at times there might not be space for emotional vulnerability, or the same space that the others would expect from men would
Have you
not
like,
be given to men.
right. That's such a great point. So, in your dating history, when you go out and meet new people, when you start dating new people, is that something you feel anxious about that she or, you know, whoever the person you're dating is soon going to find out that I express my emotional needs and will they be put off by me?
I do get apprehensive about and anxious about that aspect, and I think it is to do with like how will this person take me as a like, or see me as a person if, you know, I'm having like a breakdown or I'm feeling really low, and I'm feeling very low self-confidence, and it is something that I experience on a day-to-day basis also. And it's not like, even if I know the person well, even if I know my partner well, it still comes. It still is like, will this person accept me as I am? Yeah, so that does happen.
You know, I was thinking about this that oftentimes, especially for example during sex, if a man is not in the mood for sex or says no or isn't able to really get in the mood, I think women take it a bit personally that because a men, for example, always supposed to be wanting it, always ready. And it's women who are the ones who get have the luxury of saying not today or I don't feel like it. And if a woman initiates and a man doesn't respond, it's like a big thing, you know? But
I agree.
right? But in that situation, if there was just a conversation about rather than having a very going into your head and thinking, oh my God, what's wrong with me? If there was a more empathetic conversation with the person, with the man in the situation, if it's a hetero relationship, it would be so different in terms of bringing, you know, emotional safety to a relationship.
I face that even now, actually. I mean, it's like, this is something that I learned recently in therapy, that well, I'm like very open and vocal about someone else giving consent and not giving consent, you know, during the process of sex itself. I don't apply the same logic to myself.
Yeah.
Like, let's say if I don't want to go down on a person, or I don't want to have more than, you know, some kissing and cuddling. One is I'm not able to vocalize it, that, you know, that I don't want to do this. But also, I guess it's also important for the other person to also take a moment at that point and, you know, ask or converse about, hey, would this be okay? Or, hey, are you not in a mood?
Yeah.
I think it should happen. That space needs to be created not only by men, but also...
Yeah, consent is a two-way street. It's not just men. I mean, yes, historically, men have been the ones who have had the most problems with consent, but it's not just men who need to ask consent and get it. It's women as well that need to ask the comfort and the safety of their male partners and get the consent.
If you experience that space, you would also want to give it to another person. That space of, like, if you experience the space of just being yourself, you would also be willing to create the space for others, for them being themselves.
So, you know, when you first became aware of the nuances of feminism and patriarchy, and did it affect your sex life in that you were scared of, because in order to have Often, in order to have sex, you need to have some degree of objectification. And that is the age-old conundrum of how can you be a feminist as well as be an object for that period. You know, you need to objectify the other person. The other person needs to objectify you a little bit. So was there a confusion in your mind? Did it ruin sex for you for a while?
I was being extra careful. And it didn't ruin my sex life as such, but I was apprehensive about what I should be doing and what I should not be doing in a very extreme manner. Like, I would not be okay if, let's say the person I'm having sex with that day is okay going down on me. I would still feel ashamed. Like, I'd be like, is it okay if for you to go down on me? It can again, you know, reinforce morality because you feel like this is how. So basically, in porn, there are particular ways of having sex, right? And if that is what is being replicated again, I would think about is this okay or not? But it took me a while to understand that. I mean, it's fine as long as we are actually doing what we like doing.
Yeah.
Even though if we are replicating the same things that we see on. In porn itself, but as long as it's like, you know, we like and we're talking about it and being empathetic, I think then it's fine.
So shame, you said the word ashamed. Shame is a really powerful emotion, isn't it?
Yeah.
How do men deal with shame? Because very few people express that. And men especially find it very hard to express that. They seem to internalize it a lot more. So what are some of the toxic ways in which you yourself have dealt with your feelings of shame?
Generally, you distract yourself. I think that's the major warfare sort of term. Like, it's a weapon, right, for men. That it's distraction is the go-to mechanism for almost everything. You do something else. You just watch porn, or you just go and drink, or you just do something as long as your mind is away from the things that you need to think about. So it kind of, for me, it was that. It was whenever I would feel emotions of shame or anything, you distract yourself and do something else. So that would be the go-to mechanism.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right that it's something that it does take time to identify when you're feeling shamed. Yeah, I think it's important to identify that and then being able to articulate it. Shame of, you know, let's say not performing, not being able to. For example, I I think my first, you know, pino when I vaginal sexual intercourse was probably when I was 23 or 24. But the fact that I hadn't had experiences of, you know, pino vaginal intercourse, I would always be, you know, the feeling of shame would come because I would be like, I don't know how to have sex, sexual intercourse, and what would the person I'm, you know, dating, or they be okay in, you know, me not knowing what to do.
Yeah. I can imagine you would have felt the pressure because women are supposed to be completely sexually unaware and virgins, and men are supposed to be studs who know how to do it from the day they are born. You know, men are supposed to take charge, especially in the Indian context.
I mean, as simple as even putting on a condom, like you haven't done it for the first time. And you, it's like we never, at least in our circles, we never have sex education unless you look up online.
And then again, you're not actually typing sex education online. You're typing all sorts of silly things. Did you and your dad ever talk about sex or relationships or feelings?
Sex, no. I realized that, I mean, with parents especially and dad, my parents are someone who would probably not talk about these things in a very direct manner. Like, I have written about it. There was a period where I did write mails. Males talking about the fact that, hey, I'm feeling jealous about my partner seeing someone else. Basically, I titled this mail, called it Voices in My Head. And it was in a way me initiating this conversation and talking about the fact that for a long period of time, you know, I have never expressed what I go through in my head.
You send these to your parents?
Yeah, I sent this to my dad.
Oh, wow, you are brave, man. I mean, first of all, that you sent your parents emails about your feelings is a big one, but then also that you sent them emails about what sounds like an open relationship.
Yeah, it was going through that phase, and that way I have opened up conversations in different ways with parents. But what I realized is that, yeah, it's not like I got a reply to this email, but in the same mail, I had talked about the fact that I'm going through low phases of mental health. So it was in that context. But they, while they didn't talk about the mail specifically, they showed care in different ways by, you know, calling me, and, you know, we had a Skype call, or they would come and meet me. So it was care in different ways. In a way, disappointed that, you know, I can't have direct conversations. But now I'm more okay not having, you know, sitting and saying, hey, I'm feeling this. What do you think? Kind of okay with them not being okay with having, you know, direct conversations about things. And I guess I realized that it's going to take time for my parents or my dad, especially, to be able to ask about, you know, but I also recognize the fact that they're listening to me. They're not like shutting me down, and they are in a way responding in, you know, kind ways, empathetic ways, but not probably in the direct way that I had expected.
Well, that's a step in the right direction. I mean, that the fact that they didn't acknowledge the email isn't great, but the fact that they still didn't shut off the communication channels. But that, you know, that just shows they have tremendous love for you, and it shows that they appreciate being let into your head. So what model of masculinity did your dad model for you when you were growing up? Was it a helpful one for you? Was it toxic?
It was in a way where you don't talk about your emotions that much. That was one. And so there was a situation which I think it kind of shows the, you know, the model of masculinity that was there. It's that we were in a restaurant, and we had asked for drinking water, and this the restaurant owner was like, you have to buy bottled water. And I was like, but you're supposed to give like normal, purified drinking water, and I shouldn't have to buy bottled water. I was trying to have a conversation, and this person wasn't listening to me, and I was trying to say, but this is not fair. But my dad was more like his response to that was he raised his voice fully. It's something that I don't do generally. It's like you raise your voice and then you kind of intimidate the person, and that worked at that point. And what I was doing didn't work, so I kind of felt like how am I going to survive in this world? I mean, if this is going to get things done. And he's been someone who would be okay intimidating or being loud or
I've grown up in a family of mostly women. So I have a younger sister and my mum. So the three women in the house are very open and communicative with each other. And I think that's rubbed off on my dad. But what I know of for example, my dad has two other siblings, and there are two brothers, and then there's one sister. So the sister was treated differently than the two brothers by their father. Similarly, in my mom's household, she has a brother as well, and she and her brother were treated differently in terms of the brothers were treated a bit more roughly than the girls.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, in that sense, I also faced that sort of disciplinarian, authoritative sort of a model. Till probably high school, even I was, beaten if I did something wrong.
But it's okay to beat a boy because there is some feeling that boys are just tougher.
Yeah, that's true. It has been like that, and the model has been in some sort of an angry man, angry disciplinary man sort of a thing for a large part of my childhood at least. It has changed now. I mean, the relationship that I have with my dad is very different from before. Like when we hug right now, and it's like this is never there before. So.
Obviously, we need to encourage men to take responsibility for their actions, but that begins with awareness and
Agreed.
compassion for oneself. I'm not talking about an inflated sense of entitlement. Entitlement is different, but compassion is something which more people could have and show for themselves and for the parts of themselves which are, unspeakable or terrible. So in that sense, in terms of openly expressing feelings, in terms of understanding and making space for emotions, in men's circles, how can India do better?
I can speak for the men like me. I think as basic as just trying to understand what is happening in each of our lives. I think you can just start with that, like trying to understand what kind of stress that you're going through, either in work or in relationship. Once you start, talking about as basic things as your day-to-day emotions, I think big change will happen within just the circle of men. Instead of like when you meet, you generally say, "Hey, how are you? How is your work going?" But the conversation just stops there, and you generally say, "I'm fine and I'm doing this," and then you just suddenly move on to some other conversations. While that is also great, I mean, I'm not denying that that should never happen, but one can also open spaces by taking the lead by saying, "Hey, let's talk about our lives. Let's not always talk about other things." And I have done that and with my friends, and it works. And they're like, "Yeah, let's talk about it." And we talk about how we feel and what is happening in our families. And it can start with that. And if change has to happen within our lives, then it has to start in these ways, in trying to understand how to deal with situations in a relationship. How to, I mean, I don't know if you've read it, but there's this person who goes by the name Nora Samarin, that she had written a piece called "The Opposite of Rape Culture is Nurturance Culture." And there are some pieces like that which talk about our day-to-dayness and really talk about how do you bring nurturance culture in the relationships that we have.
Yeah, men are not frequently seen as nurturers, are they?
Yeah, that's true. They aren't seen that way. And I think, and as basic as, you know, talking about, are you listening to your partner? Are you, like, you know, taking a step back and understanding? Are you talking over your partner most of the time? So if you just keep a count, or let's say if you're in a meeting, if there are women in the group, are you talking over women more? I mean, just to be reflective of it. And essentially, yeah, therapy helps in a big way to for those who can afford it, of course.
I suppose when you start showing empathy for others, it rubs off and you start showing empathy for yourself as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you listen to others, then you suddenly start thinking about what you're saying and why you're saying it and start listening to yourself a bit more.
That's true.
Yeah.
And it is essential for your own good if you are able to reflect on your emotions and be healthy, actually. Mm. I think on one side, we need to kind of talk about mental health and talk about the myths of therapy in general.
Yeah.
And on the other side, for men to have access and also for to kind of encourage men to access therapy if they can is something that does help.
True. Yeah. So here's a sort of parting question for you. What do you wish women would understand about men? Or what do you wish the women would understand better about men?
I feel like generally I feel like women do understand men more than men understanding women.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that generally there is already that's there. And I think it's the fact that men just don't open up makes it more harder for, you know, others to understand what men are thinking and all of that. I mean, I feel like it's a very difficult question to...
Sorry.
I've never thought of it that way. So I would actually frame it this way, that I think... I don't think there are essential, you know, essentialized factors about men that women don't understand. But I guess all one would ask for is maybe at least the once in, you know, your lives, like personal lives...
Hmm.
You can be more kind and empathetic and allow space for emotions.
Yeah.
And if men are being vulnerable and allowing space for that vulnerability, I think that's important. I think from that, you will gain, like women will gain an understanding of men, I guess I would say.
Yeah. No, that's such a good point. But also going back to what you were saying before, that women seem to understand men, but it's probably not the same vice versa. My friend made a very interesting observation. She said female writers write quite complex male characters.
Yeah.
But male writers frequently write very one or two dimensional female characters.
Yep. Yeah.
I wonder why that is. You're a writer, right? So you, why do you think that is?
The way I look at the world is that the ones on the top, which is like the cis male sort of a space, they don't have to think about, you know, another person, or they don't have to think about what is the complexity of, you know, another person.
Mm.
But the ones who do face, you know, social realities that affect their lives, their choices and their decisions, it's inevitable that, you know, one will analyze the society better.
Yeah, yeah.
Than the ones who are sitting on the top.
Yeah, you make a good point. Interesting. Yeah. So if today's conversation was, you know, speaking in terms of stories and stuff like that, if today's conversation was a fable, what would we say is the moral of the story?
For me, at least, I think the conversation that we had just now is what... sorry, my cat. I guess the kind of conversation that we had is something that needs to happen more.
Right. I agree. Yeah, that's the moral of the story. Have more conversations about feelings with each other, particularly with men. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess that's how it works. You'll have to sit and have conversations about it, and it's going to be difficult, but I guess it's important also.
Yeah. So, Mitra, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
It has been wonderful.
Too.
Yeah, it has been a really enlightening and interesting conversation. I really enjoyed myself.
The questions that you pose is something that I hadn't sat and, you know, talked about it like this for a while. It was a good experience to do this again.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
You did very well.
Yeah.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Heck, 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 heck